I just remember that moment of being like, I can't live with substances anymore, but I can't live without them and I don't know what to do. So I opted to get into treatment, and that's where I started seeing a lot of problems and the need for a solution like ours.
Hey, this is the Built in Seattle podcast. I'm Adam Schoenfeld. On this show, I chat with Seattle's best entrepreneurs, operators, and investors about how they think and how they operate. On this episode, I talked with Daniela Luzzi Tudor, the founder of We Connect Health. She has an incredible story about her own substance addiction that led to the idea for We Connect. Her co-founder, Murphy Jensen, had similar experiences after being a professional tennis player and winner of the French Open doubles tournament in 1993. She's super open about her story. She talks about what led her to We Connect, some of the principles she took from recovery into building her culture, and how she's building her business in this complex world of B2B2C and grow a company in a tough but large and massive category. I'm sitting here with the one, the only, Daniela Luzzi Tudor. I've been a big fan of yours ever since we met about a year ago. You have a very personal, compelling story behind your business about addiction that I want to get into today. But your business isn't typical. Like, I can't put you into enterprise software or a B2C app. How do you describe what you do? What is the category that this exists in?
Yeah, so we're a digital therapeutic in the healthcare space, and we are B2B2C, which is probably one of the most complex models that you can go after, but it's what fits for what we do, and it fits and what works to serve the patients that get the application for free. Ultimately, we sell to large healthcare systems, health plans, and large providers in the healthcare space. And then we actually help implement our software and our mobile application to the patient, but the patient ends up getting it and all the benefits for free.
Gotcha. B2B2C.
Yes.
So yes, that sounds very complex in terms of how you actually go to market and sort of deploy the product. Has that been hard to explain to investors and just others that are interested in the business?
Yes, because usually they want a straightforward answer, who's your customer? And we really have two customers, but from a mission standpoint, what has to be successful and what we've proven that is successful is that the patients are using the mobile application to help them in their recovery. And that's what substantiates the data. That's what improves population health. And ultimately, that's the value that we bring to the health plans and the healthcare systems that pay for the platform. And so that has always been a difficult thing to explain because we do have technically two customers, but when we make product decisions, the priority is the end user, the patient that is utilizing the mobile application.
Was that always your focus, or did you have to go through some iteration to arrive at the answer to who's your customer?
We've gone through some iterations because obviously product and engineering, they need to know where to focus and they need that sort of golden answer of who are we making the decisions for? We build technology for a primary customer. So I always knew that I wanted the product to be for free for patients, especially folks that are suffering from substance use disorder. Typically when they get out of treatment or they walk into a treatment program, financial hardships is one of the social determinants of health that's really difficult for them. So I knew that I wanted it to be free for the patient, and I also knew the problems that we're solving for the healthcare systems. So it was definitely in the first couple of years a discussion of who is our actual customer? But I always knew what I wanted the end result to be. So that's never been an argument. It was just about how do we focus from an engineering perspective? What do we prioritize first? Especially when health plans are asking for custom features, and then we have to tell them, well, this is going to get prioritized this way. And we've had to educate them on if we're making the patient successful and using the mobile application, this is how it trickles down for your return on investment. And why is it that you're asking for that feature? Is it because you think that you know technology in a way that is going to benefit you, but not the customer? So that's always been more of an educational opportunity for everybody involved. Definitely a lot of discussions have happened over the years in regards to that.
For sure. Were there any role models that you looked at or other companies that had this kind of approach that you learned from, or did you have to kind of figure this all out on your own.
Yeah, I mean, even our category, which is within digital therapeutics, specifically in the substance use disorder space, even though we are leading in terms of patient engagement, our metrics are far and above anybody else in the space, it's still an emerging market. So I wouldn't even call us to be so arrogant as to call us a leader, because nobody's actually captured the majority of the market. It's a completely new emerging space. And in terms of the business model, we've had to just figure it out and create it. So
that's fascinating. I love that. I mean, and sometimes you hear entrepreneurs get dissuaded from pursuing a business because VCs and others say, well, I've never seen that model, or that model doesn't kind of fit into a box that I'm used to. And you guys have been able to push forward with that. That's fantastic. I would love to talk about your founding story and how you arrived at this problem and this opportunity. Can you share more about kind of how this came into focus for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So my career started in technology. I built system engineers and software development teams for large enterprise companies. My first customer out of college was actually Microsoft when they were hiring a lot of contractors. So I helped build consulting teams for them. And after that, I jumped 100% into entrepreneurship. I started a business that was a very niche product in the music tech art space, which is also very different. It was called Soundstrokes Art. And we would take the visual waveform of your favorite sound and turn it into a real life painting. So you could get a picture of your favorite song for music producers and people in the music industry. You could get a painting of you saying I love you to your partner or your baby's heartbeat, which turned out to be the more profitable market. And during that time, I was living with my co-founder. Her and I had an apartment in Los Angeles together. And being in the music industry and selling this into the music industry, we would obviously go out and network at a lot of events. And so after a couple of years of doing that together, what became very apparent is that when we would go out, you know, I would continue to use substances for a few days on end, whereas she would get up the next morning and be really productive. And we had a really close relationship. She's actually my best friend now in the entire world. She's like my sister. And she sat me down in the most unconditional, loving way and said, look, like, I think substances are really affecting you in a way that's really detrimental to our business. And because I love you, I think you should go get help. And I think I need to move out. And so that was the first time that somebody approached me about my addictive behaviors in a most loving way. And so I was able to hear her. So I moved back to Seattle thinking that Los Angeles was my problem, which is part of the denial process for a lot of people going through this. And for 18 months, not knowing anything about addiction, I tried to stop on my own, which was very difficult. So finally, now it's a total blessing. I actually got a DUI. I got pulled over on the 520 bridge, and I ended up having to get a breathalyzer in my car. I thought that would change course for me, but it didn't. And so I missed my arraignment for my DUI. And I got booked in SCORE in the correctional facility in Burien because the Kirkland Jail was getting renovated. So I just remember that moment of being like, I can't live with substances anymore, but I can't live without them and I don't know what to do. So I opted to get into treatment, and that's where I started seeing a lot of problems and the need for a solution like ours. Because for one, it took me 3 days to get a bed in a treatment center. I locked myself in my parents' house because I was afraid I would change my mind about going in. And I went in, and when the counselor did my intake, because I wasn't intoxicated, he actually saved my life because he said, I'm going to write down that you're actually intoxicated right now. Otherwise, insurance isn't going to pay for your 28-day stay. They're not going to think you're severe enough. And I said, if I go to outpatient, I'm not going to make it. I can tell you that I have to go to inpatient treatment. So very, very blessed that I was able to do that. I went into a treatment center for a 28-day period, and that's where everything changed and the idea for We Connect Health came about. So I learned that the relapse rate for this chronic illness of substance use disorder is 80% in the first year. So I connected with athletes, with business people, with homeless women that were pregnant. It was just a variety of people in there, and we connected on a very deep level. And I realized that 80% of us are going to overdose or pass away in the next year. And that was completely unacceptable to me. I looked around and I noticed clinicians were doing their best work. However, They were doing things on pen and paper, looking at paper slips if people attended 12-step meetings, which is self-reported data. They were texting and calling frantically to see how the patients were doing post-inpatient care. And on my last day, in my discharge session, I got a piece of paper that was my treatment plan, which listed 10 things that I'm supposed to do on a daily basis to stay in recovery. This was anything from outpatient sessions to therapy to 12-step meetings to exercising to meditation. And I thought, no wonder that people are relapsing out of treatment. And so I had journaled in the previous week already about thinking how technology could bridge that gap between being connected to your care team 24/7 and also staying accountable to those treatment plan activities. So that's where the idea for We Connect Health came about.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. It's an unreal story. I mean, I think there's lots of founders that have experienced the problem that they're trying to solve, but the way you have is on a different level, right? To have that kind of experience and that kind of major life event drive you in this direction. What, I mean, when you talk about, you know, your friends sitting you down and then the DUI, it sounds like you still had a tremendous amount of courage and sort of resolve to go inpatient. You locked yourself in your parents' house for 3 days. Do you think that's typical of people? It sounds like you arrived at that pretty quickly. Like, how were you able to do that?
I mean, I think it has to do with a couple of things. One, I immigrated here when I was 13 with my parents. I was born in Romania during communism, and my parents sacrificed a lot to get us here. And so I felt like I really owe them to be successful, and I wanted to make them proud. So in part, it wasn't about so much my resolve and motivation is that I wanted to prove to them that I did everything that I could to solve this issue that I was going through. And then I think a lot of people get to that spot where really it's a point of no choice. If I kept going, I wouldn't be alive anymore. I know that. and so I think it was more of lack of choices that drove me to just try this one last thing. And to be honest, I didn't know if treatment was going to work, but I knew that I had to exhaust all of the options that I had in front of me. And I think a lot of people get to that place where that's not a new phrase that I said. You know, people realize that they're sick and tired of feeling sick and tired, and that's the only option that they have. I think one of the motivational drives that you have as an entrepreneur, which did prove to be useful, is that when I got discharged from inpatient, I did do everything that they told me. And some people don't do that. I went into sober living. I started going to 12 steps. I started therapy, outpatient. I did everything that they told me. So I think at that point where I had a little bit of clarity of 28 days of being off of the substances, that's where that motivation that is an entrepreneurial trait came in. But before that, it was really like, this is my only choice.
Wow. How has that put the problems you have in your business in perspective? When somebody quits, or, you know, you get a negative Glassdoor review, or you lose a customer, has that shaped the way you respond and engage in problems of, you know, building a company?
Absolutely, it has. I will say that sometimes I do lose perspective and I think like, oh, this problem is so big. But then inadvertently, I do go back to that moment of 5 years ago. And I'm like, well, things were much worse back then. I didn't know what the future held for me. I certainly was not sure that we were going to be at this amazing point where we built this incredible company 5 years later. And so it does help with that. And also actually tools that I've learned in recovery have helped me shape the culture at WeConnect. So there's a lot of elements from therapy and from recovery that I've leveraged to build a healthy culture at the company. And also just in talking with people that I work with, our partners and investors, having some of those principles that recovery and therapy teaches you have been really useful in actually just building the company, period.
That's amazing. Can you share some of those principles and tools that you learned in recovery that you're now applying to your business? Because most of us wouldn't have the opportunity to learn those things. That's
yeah. So we actually start off every meeting, if it's a large meeting, particularly with a 1 minute of silence, so 1 minute of meditation. We pick a couple people to share where they're at physically, mentally, emotionally, which it does is it breaks down barriers. People have a better understanding of where they're at, especially with remote employees. It's bridged their connections to the employees on site to be a lot closer. And it allows people to be more human, to be more productive at work. So that's one of the elements. And then one of the elements that my chairman of my board actually has taught me, he's been in recovery for 35 years. He's been an incredible investor and mentor to the business and to me personally, is he talks about, you know, when you're working with employees, it's all about just creating safety and allowing them to be transparent and honest with you about what's going on. So some of the methods that we use are from a framework called StratOp by Tom Patterson. And actually, Tom Patterson, coincidentally, I believe is also in recovery. I've never met him. This is a framework that a lot of companies use. And one of the things that we do is we allow each employee to share during our retreats, what's wrong, what's right, what's confusing, what's missing at the company, which of course for a founder can be really hard to hear sometimes. But what it does is allows everybody to have a voice. It brings all the issues right up to the top to be able to be solved. And that's been really effective for us to get through the obstacles that we're facing and just allows us to operate as a healthier organization overall.
Wow, those are impressive. I've never been in a meeting where it started with 1 minute of silence, but I absolutely want to try that. With the piece where you ask people where they are, it was physically, emotionally,
and mentally.
What are the answers people give? I'm trying to think how I would respond to that.
I mean, some people talk about how they want to, you know, exercise more for the week, or maybe somebody in their family is struggling, or you know, why they might be checked out for the day, or why they're excited, what they're working on. So it just gives people a voice to share with a larger group where they're really at. But it really varies across the board. Some people just share that they're good. We don't, you know, encourage people to overshare if they don't feel comfortable, but it really gives them a chance and opportunity to do so, and they know that it's safe to do that. So
how do you action that? Do you take note on what people say and follow up, or is it just something that, you know, kind of happens to set the stage for the day?
It just happens to set the stage for the day. We don't take notes on it. Sometimes my CEO and I are pretty intuitive, and if we notice that somebody's struggling with something, you know, maybe we'll pull them aside and make sure that they're okay. But typically it's more just in the moment. We don't take notes on it or anything like that.
Okay. Are there any other big principles that you've brought from therapy and recovery into running your business and being a leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the principles in recovery is what's called taking inventory. So even if you're frustrated and you think that you're right about a certain situation, it's taking perspective on what your part is in it. Inadvertently, if you're feeling conflict or disagreement about something, you ultimately do have a part in it. It may be really small in some situations, or it may be really big. But what it does is it helps you understand the full perspective and also walk in somebody else's shoes. And then if you are wrong, I think a lot of leaders feel like they have to be right, or they have to show up a certain way with a mask. What it's allowed me to do is to just transparently admit when I'm wrong, and I'm certainly not perfect at it. But what it does, again, it really builds trust between you and your partners and employees. It allows you to see that bigger perspective that maybe you don't always see. And I think the other part is also just emotion regulation. I think a lot of founders feel like they have to be positive and optimistic all the time. I don't believe in that. I think you have to let yourself feel your feelings so that there's no buildup and you show up better as a leader. There's an appropriate time to do that. You know, I think I really want to encourage leaders to be able to, if they're angry or they're sad, to be able to do that. And with the appropriate person or at home, personally, be able to process those emotions is another thing. Because if you're holding in all those feelings, people are very intuitive. They can tell if you're upset, even if you're putting on a face. And if you don't process those with the appropriate channel through therapy at home or wherever that may be, it's going to actually bleed into your business, and it's going to create a certain mood at the company that may not be the healthiest route to go.
Awesome. Love those things. And what a unique perspective you've been able to bring to developing your own culture and principles, and like those little cues that you use in meetings and how you operate. You mentioned Tom Patterson, who was in recovery, and your chairman, who had been in recovery for 35 years. Just a very 101 question: what are the right phrases to use? Is it past tense? You know, with addict, addiction, recovery? What's the way that people should talk about this stuff?
Thank you for asking that, actually, because one of the things that we want to do as a result of our company is actually break down the stigma. And there's actually a cheat sheet I can send you on what the correct terms are. So instead of addiction, the appropriate term is substance use disorder. And then instead of addict or junkie, as some people refer to it, is actually person in long-term recovery. So it's a chronic condition. You're always going to be in recovery. You always have to take your quote unquote medication, which is practicing whatever recovery looks like for you, whether that's meditation, 12 steps, therapy, medically assisted treatment. So I think those are the most important terms that we really need to continue to push forward in our industry and for people alike to break down the stigma that exists. And Robert Ashford, who is a PhD at University of Penn, he actually developed the appropriate language that's positive versus stigmatizing. And he's done a great job of spreading the word about the kind of language we need to use to help with breaking down the stigma.
Okay, well, I've learned something today because I would not have known, and I was a little hesitant to ask, right? Because I'm not.
I'm glad you asked. Most people don't ask about that, and so I'm very, very grateful that you asked.
Okay, great. Well, you've already mentioned people around your company, people that influenced you. I believe your co-founder also has had an experience with substance mm-hmm. use disorder. I guess. Why have you decided to be so open about sharing your story? Because the first time we met, you hardly knew me, and you told me this whole story, at least the Cliff Notes version. I imagine you have to repeat it all the time for investors and customers and things. What motivated you to share? It's a prevalent problem, but a lot of people not as open. What kind of drove you to do that?
Yeah, so I just remember about my own journey. And actually, when I was going to the University of Washington when I was young, I ended up going into... I was feeling really sick, and in part of that was because actually I'd been using substances for like a week-long bender. And I remember going into the physician's office, and actually I broke down to her and I told her, you know, I'm actually using drugs and alcohol. I'd like to change that. I want to do something different. And in medical school, they don't actually really teach you about addiction or substance use disorder, which is very strange since this is such a prevalent thing. And so in her mind, she thought, well, she's recognizing a problem. She's going to go get help. But what would have been helpful is for her to actually give me tools and a method by which to treat it. So I realized that by being more open with my story, we can change the industry the way that it's approached. And also we can break down barriers, because I think a lot of people still think that people experiencing homelessness are the only people that are going through addiction issues. And that's not the truth. Families of all socioeconomic levels and backgrounds and demographic are experiencing this, but everybody's afraid to talk about it because of the stigma. So by being more open about it and me having a different face of what they might perceive of somebody in long-term recovery is only going to help people get help earlier. I think about that moment when I was at University of Washington, and I would never change anything about my journey. I wouldn't be here today. But someone like me potentially could get help earlier if this is something that's openly talked about. Just like with the HIV epidemic, people were a lot of times afraid to talk about it. Now it's much less stigmatized. Now people know what to do to get help, and they can live happy and healthy lives, get the treatment that they need. So that same kind of shift is what needs to happen. And the only way we can do that is by telling our stories.
Have you had to work on the way you tell the story? Like how does it come out now versus, you know, a few years ago? Have you had to hone that as part of your craft, or is it just a very natural thing?
It's pretty natural. I think I've just shortened the story a little bit more and just been a little bit more direct about it. There were instances before where I did have some hesitation, and I definitely had to work through that. But at the end of the day, I knew that I had to be open about my story in order to break down the stigma and move things forward. So
in a business context, like if you're pitching to an investor or talking to a customer, what percentage of the time does your personal story actually come up or become part of the conversation?
I start my pitch that way, and I make it pretty short and sweet if it is a 30-minute investor story. But, you know, I let them know I'm a person in long-term recovery. This is how I came up with the idea. But I hone in on the problem that we're solving, which is, again, the clinicians being empowered with our tool to be able to see how, you know, people's risk level where they wouldn't be able to see that without our tool, and also the statistics around it. So I make it a little bit more about the statistics and the problem that we're solving, but interweaved in that is because I've experienced it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think a lot of founders forget to weave their own story into this stuff. And obviously yours, you know, has a huge emotional personal component to it, but all of us have some story behind our company. I think there's a lot people can learn from listening to you, I hope. I certainly have. I wanted to talk about how you met your co-founder, because that's also a really interesting story. Can you share that?
Yeah, so I was about 90 days into my recovery journey. Richard Branson has been a huge inspiration to me because he's forged the path in multiple different industries, and I also have some additional projects outside of We Connect Health. I hope to model his ability to make an impact in multiple industries, while my mission is the same, which is to transform the way we approach substance use disorder. And so I've been a huge fan of him for a long time, and I saw this contest that came up put on by a company called Bucket Dream. And the ask was, submit your top three bucket list items and we'll pick a winner to go to Necker Island for Necker Cup and spend 5 days on Richard Branson's private island. So I applied to the contest, and I'm sure it was thousands and thousands of entries, and I ended up winning this contest. My three bucket list items were to go on a volunteer mission during a natural disaster abroad. The second was to go on the World Ship for a year, which is this like cruise ship essentially with 100 condo units on it that just travels around the world. And then the third is to be on an airplane going over different time zones during New Year's Eve. So you experience New Year's multiple times. And I got picked as the winner, and I was 90 days into my recovery. I knew I was going to walk into a huge party, essentially. And so I brought my first 12-step sponsor with me to the island. You could bring a guest. And I arrived on the island. Funny story, Al, actually, before I get to how I met my co-founder, I was very nervous to meet him. The night before, my 12-step sponsor and I go to dinner, and I felt a funny feeling on my eye, and I go into the bathroom, and this giant mosquito had bitten my eyelid. So I had this huge puffy eye the night before, and it actually was a blessing because it broke down any kind of like anxiety I had over it, because at that point I'm like, well, he's going to meet me with a puffy eye, so I guess it doesn't matter anymore. So it just made the conversation very natural between us. And I remember seeing this person emceeing the tennis tournament that was very charismatic. He wasn't drinking alcohol like with everybody else. And I came back and somebody in my outpatient said, hey, my ex-girlfriend's sister is married to this individual that was on the island with you. He's in long-term recovery. He's a former pro tennis player. He won the French Open in 1993. I think you should talk to him about your business idea. So we ended up getting in touch, and we had a phone conversation. He came out to Seattle to visit, and then a few months later, he moved his family up here to start the business. And that's Murphy Jensen. He's an incredible human being. His work ethic is incredible, of course, being a former pro athlete. And what he has is the ability to create and forge relationships like nobody else I've ever seen. So he's driven a lot of our fundraising strategy, also bringing in enterprise customers for us with high level executives at health plans. He's just an incredible partner to me and friend, and I'm just really proud of him and his journey. So
you won a contest, went to Richard Branson's island, where you met your co-founder but didn't connect then, and then later found somebody who connected those dots and you met up. Well, that would be a hard co-founder story to repeat, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be. Yeah, so, you know, when people ask me, how do you find the right co-founder, I actually talk about be very self-aware of what your strengths and weaknesses are, and you should find a co-founder that complements your what you're lacking. So I think that's the one thing that can be replicated out of our relationship is that we complement each other perfectly. And he brings different communication perspectives and also his ability, again, to forge relationships with high net worth people and high level executives is really impressive. And then obviously I have the tech background and all of that. Though I will say now Murphy is very well versed in tech. So he's a very quick learner. very good work ethic. So that's the one thing I would take away when you're trying to find your co-founder, though, is be very aware of your shortcomings and try to find that in somebody else.
How'd that conversation go when you both came back from the island and then connected? How did you find common ground and identify those areas where you complemented each other?
So first off, we just talked about our own personal recovery stories, and I told him the why of what I'm trying to build. And actually, one of his mentors, who's one of our advisors, is a gentleman that worked for the NFL Association and worked with celebrities as a sober companion. So there was an extra step there. But essentially, I told Murphy what I was looking for. And Murphy said that he was actually looking to get out of doing fundraisers with his tennis career, and he wanted to do something meaningful with his network. So that was a perfect compliment. And then he had me meet Scott in an airport coffee shop, who was his mentor, in person, because I hadn't met Murphy in person at this point. And what I didn't realize is I was getting vetted. So Scott and I sat down, shared our recovery story. And at the end of the day, I think Murphy and Scott just saw that, like them, we really just want to help people. And that's at the core of that. And that's the foundation. And that's the focus. And they were on the same mission. And that's what they're passionate about. So that's how we really connected.
Got it. So you aligned on mission. And how did you discover, you know, the strengths and weaknesses and complementary skills? Like, how did that show up or win in the conversation?
Yeah. So, I mean, I told him about, you know, what I was trying to build, and Murphy had a lot of curiosity around technology. He hadn't been in the technology space, so he saw that as a strength in me. He shared with me that he has relationships with high net worth people that could bring the kind of capital, but also the right kind of capital. So investors that are passionate about social impact, that really understand tech and are successful in it, or are passionate about healthcare or substance use disorder because they've been affected. So I saw that as a need that I was really looking for. And so that's how that conversation went.
Okay. How had he already established this network of people? This might be a naive question, but people with substance use disorder or people who are in long-term recovery, how did he identify all these high-profile people with something that has such a stigma and people aren't really sharing their stories?
Well, yeah. So like I said, Murphy's incredible at forging relationships, and through his tennis career, I mean, he's a superstar in tennis, and he actually continuously wins awards for his career still to this day. And he just crafted a really close network of people. When you're in recovery and the level of celebrity that he's been at, those people actually really do connect with each other and they network with each other. It's a support system, and they also understand the sort of confidentiality that needs to happen. And so they connect with each other. And also, since he'd been a pro tennis player, a lot of people will ask him to do fundraisers for their causes. And so those people are high net worth people that are seeking people like Murphy to do tennis tournaments, offer lessons in exchange for donations. So he built that network throughout the last few decades, really.
Wow, that's incredible. So his, you know, own personal experience got him. It's interesting because Peter Thiel has this thing like, you need to be in a scene. And it's interesting how both of you kind of got into the scene of your end user, mm-hmm. right, by being that and building that network. I mean, I'm sure there's probably, you know, it's a hard way to have to learn it, but it sounds like that was pretty critical for both of you to have had that experience.
Yes, definitely.
And connect with all those people. Well, that's fantastic that all those folks are finding each other and able to connect. I wanted to ask you about the numbers, because now you've mentioned all these high profile people that are involved in your company. How many people does this affect? Like, what are we talking about here? What's the scope of this problem in our country and our society?
Yeah. So just to give you some idea, a substance use disorder costs $740 billion a year when you're taking into account criminal justice system, healthcare cost, and work loss productivity is actually the bulk of that. And then from a numbers perspective, there's 20.8 million people in long-term recovery today in the U.S. There's 22 million people that need or are seeking recovery for substance use disorder. And then also, we're not even counting the people that have substance misuse and dual diagnosis of other behavioral health disorders. So the magnitude of the problem is incredibly large. It's affecting 1 in 10 Americans. 1 in 3 Americans are affected by it as a byproduct, whether it's a family member or coworker. So the magnitude of the problem, it is the largest public health crisis of our time. And out of that 22 million people that are seeking services or need services, only 3.1 million get into inpatient treatment every year. So there's no, without us, there's no low-cost solution where they can get the support that they need or the financial stability or the proper healthcare services. There's all these rural areas in America where a clinic is like 50 miles away. And so there's no way for them to get the service they need unless they get something on their phone that's digital that helps them bridge that gap. We actually implemented a program in West Virginia, and we found out that a number of those counties don't even have cell tower service. So while our product can still work within that context and still help them, they don't even have the proper cell tower service consistently to be able to get the help that they need, much less thinking about having kids at home and then having to take a day off work if they are even employed to go to a clinic and get the services that they need. So the problem is massive and we have a really long way to go.
Wow. Do people know the magnitude of this problem when you meet them and they get the sort of the headline or get introduced to your business? Or is this surprising and new to most?
I think it depends. I mean, I think people see the news headlines, but the problem with the media is that they're not approaching it from a very human way. And they'll tell the story about people experiencing homelessness or people getting arrested, but they're not really talking as much as they should. There's a lot of people in my industry that are doing a great job of bringing that to the forefront, particularly with doing some activism around changing the way that we prescribe pharmaceuticals. But I think we still have a long way to go on expressing the magnitude of the problem and also expressing what solutions are actually going to work. Because grants from the government take a long time, that money trickles down, and the people making those decisions aren't always as educated on what works. And frankly, there's also a complete lack of data around what works. And so that's in part of what my mission is. We're getting so much good aggregated data on what type of recovery activities work for a certain demographic or a certain type of individual. So what we set out to do is that we can actually leverage that data for research and show that for this type of person, age, demographic, geography, and substance that they're in recovery from, this is the kind of treatment plan that can work.
That's fascinating. Is there an kind of an AI play in your future around that of being able to kind of predict and prescribe solutions for different populations based on what your, as your data set grows?
Yes, absolutely. So we have a patent pending risk level algorithm right now that looks at your behavior on the app and what activities you're checking into compared to what's scheduled. Also looks at your length in recovery because there's different risk levels of relapse associated with your length in recovery, especially in that first year. And so now that we've started to aggregate sufficient amount of data, we're looking to integrating machine learning and AI in the future into it.
Very cool. So where are you with the business? It sounds like this is going to be a very long-term mission. It's certainly nobody's going to question the size of your TAM or whether there's a big problem that exists. But you know, how far have you come in terms of building your own business? You know, just talk about kind of where the business is today.
Yeah, so we first started with selling to treatment centers. And what the goal was there is to get enough people on the platform to prove that the product works. So even in instances where the clinicians are having very little engagement with the customer, what we've seen 6 months, 9 months down the line is that people are still using the application. So we were able to then use that data and those results to then go to health plans and behavioral health managed care organizations that are very large and have millions of customers with membership to show them that when people are using this platform and we onboard those patients at the providers you're working with, you will actually save on costs by increasing their health, because people are going to be avoiding the emergency room and inpatient stays more. And then we're going to be increasing utilization of people going to their primary care physician appointments, their therapy sessions, their medically assisted treatment appointments. So where we are now is we started working with the first set of health plans back in December, and we're expanding that in 2020. We'll have some big announcements around some very large organizations that we're working with. And so the long-term plan is to continue to work with really large health systems, health plans, and insurance companies, and those behavioral health managed care organizations. In terms of size, we're at 30 full-time employees today, and we've got a lot of jobs open to hire for.
30 employees, growing, adding new people. And how much capital have you raised today?
So to date, we've raised just over $11 million, and that's a combination of our Series A, our seed round, and also convertible notes.
What are you most excited about in the next phase of the business? It sounds like you're gearing up to raise more money, you're hiring, you're scaling, you have validation in the market, you have customers. It's actually come a long way since we talked, even just a little over a year ago. What's kind of next that you're most excited about?
I mean, I'm excited today and next is we have a customer feedback channel in our Slack, and every day we get anonymous customer feedback on how this is helping them. This is making a huge impact. In our mobile application, actually, as you engage with your recovery plan, we've used a body of research called contingency management, which gives you rewards in return for staying engaged in your plan. So people get Amazon gift cards to be able to get food, personal care items, gifts for their kids for their birthdays, and seeing those every single day. What I'm excited about is seeing that grow to hundreds of thousands of customer reviews a day. That's what I'm most excited about as we expand with these health plans, and then getting that aggregated data that I mentioned where we can actually start recommending best practices around what people can get help with.
Very cool. So you're doing stuff with innovation in healthcare. I probably just live in my little bubble of enterprise software, so I don't see a ton of this in Seattle. Is more of this happening in this market and other markets? Like, where do you see kind of innovation in healthcare going as part of the startup ecosystem more broadly?
Yeah, so I see a lot of large companies having an innovation hub, and also even being asked by states to bring innovations to the forefront. And I think the thing we have to traverse is that it's on us to do a really good job to prove out that these things work so they become more commonplace. Because I think a lot of large companies are rightfully so cautious around new things because they haven't been really proven yet for a long time. But innovation in the market means that we can give lower cost solutions that are effective for patients. And so I think just by doing our work, we're really transforming and bringing innovation more so to the forefront, and allowing those companies to see that these things work and it's actually affecting their bottom line in a positive way is really important. I think the other thing that needs to happen in healthcare in terms of innovation, which is happening, I'm actually part of a payment reform alliance that their press release actually went out this last week, where they're looking at doing reimbursements under what's called value-based care, which really means that you're getting reimbursed for keeping the person healthy over a long term, over a five-year period, versus just getting reimbursed fee-for-service, how many patients can you get through the door in the quickest amount of time, which is not effective all the time. So I think that's the other kind of innovation in the space, is getting financial teams at large organizations understanding that value-based care will have a better financial upside, and inadvertently through that, it will increase population health.
Awesome. Well, definitely exciting to learn about and watch, since this is something that affects all of our lives, healthcare, right? I love this story. I want to wrap up with my Supersonic Six. Corny name, as you know, but
I love when we immigrated here, my parents, we didn't have any furniture in our apartment and we had a little TV, and all we do is watch the Sonics play. So I'm a big fan.
I like you. I grew up on the Sonics and very sad that we don't have them anymore.
I'm very a big fan of Gary Payton, if you're listening.
I'm sure Gary's listening. All right. So I'll fire the questions off, and while they're rapid fire questions, please take as long as you want or as little as you want to answer. But the first one is, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I think that there is a sector of investors that come from big enterprise companies. And I think just getting more education around what an early stage startup is and the metrics and milestones they're supposed to be at, I think that's going to open up a huge opportunity of upside for those investors and also open up more local opportunities for entrepreneurs. A lot of our investors are Seattle-based as well as outside of Seattle and in Canada. And I think that just bringing more education about what early stage startups are supposed to look like and the traction they're supposed to have is going to increase the value of our ecosystem.
Got it. Was that a mystery to you in your early days of trying to answer those questions?
Yeah, a little bit. I think that, you know, again, I think there's just people are more risk averse here than other markets. The conversations were a lot easier outside of the Seattle area.
Interesting. All right, number two, if you could go back to the beginning, would you still found your company in Seattle?
Yes, I would. Though Seattle is becoming a little bit more crowded like Silicon Valley. And that's one of the reasons it was attractive to be here because the culture was different. I would still do it here. It's beautiful here. And also, I would never trade in my team for any other market. We have such an incredible team of people and they're based in Seattle. So I would still find it here.
Love it. All right, number three. Who is a Seattle company or founder that you're following or studying right now and why?
Good question. I'm actually very fascinated by the Allen Institute. They do really interesting research on the brain, so I'm very fascinated by them and I want to learn more. They do a lot of work with AI. I'm very fascinated in general about Elon Musk's Neuralink, or basically how we're integrating with technology, whereas the phone is with us outside of our bodies. I'm very fascinated by chips and different things that we're inevitably going to be integrating with as humans and the singularity that is already in process. So Allen Institute is very fascinating to me.
Okay. The sci-fi stuff. Yes. It feels like we're going to be in a sci-fi movie very soon.
Yes.
Number four, what's a truth that you know or believe but other people think is false or crazy?
I definitely think that not everybody is quite aware, or maybe they do think it's crazy, but putting your actual personal health and wellness, whether you label it spirituality or whether you label it general health, putting that first does bleed into how successful you are at your company. And I encourage people to think about that all the time. And self-care doesn't look like what traditionally people say, like taking a bubble bath or going to the masseuse. Self-care has to do with self-preservation, being honest about your feelings, taking time for yourself, even if it's 5 minutes. And I think being ruthless about that and putting that first, even when you have a million things to do, eventually gets your brain in a space where you are going to be more productive and effective. So I think putting that first is really important. And I don't think that every person is quite bought into that yet.
All right. Number five, what do you know today that you wish you'd known when you started your company?
Oh, very good question. I think one of the things that I wish I would have known before is being an entrepreneur, I tend to be over optimistic about making progress quicker. And I think just being a little bit less hard on myself and rolling with the punches a little bit more would, again, open me up to maybe having seen solutions a little bit quicker as we were going through obstacles. So I think just if I could have hindsight of like, these are all the twists and turns and pivots that it's going to take to get to this level of success before, would have been in a way nice to know, so that every time that I hit an obstacle, I wouldn't be so hard on myself.
I've been there.
I think every entrepreneur has
right?
been there.
Never but a other, straight line.
Otherwise, we never would have the vision, though. So it's kind of a paradox because we have the vision of where we know we want to get to. And just you don't get there the same way you think you're going to get there.
And if people knew all the twists and turns and obstacles, would they really go do it?
Right.
All right, number six, what asks do you have for this audience or what can this community do to help you?
I think just generally get more educated about substance use disorder, be more open about it, talk about it with your friends and family. I think that's the most important thing. Second, we are hiring, so check out our website at weconnectrecovery.com. But most of all, I think just getting educated on what's out there and being able to help your community is the most important.
And if somebody's interested in applying for one of those jobs, is it a career page on your website?
Yes.
WeConnectRecovery.com. That's the best place to apply.
Best place to apply.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you for sharing so openly. It's an amazing story. I've been a fan of yours. Love watching your company grow. I'm really excited to see you make some change in the world for the long term. For people who want to follow you or keep in touch, where should they go? How should they either connect with you or kind of follow your journey?
Absolutely. You can find me on LinkedIn at Daniela Luzzi Tudor and then follow our company at WeConnectRecovery.com.
Perfect. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun and I appreciate you a lot. So thank you.
Would you like to drop the mic?
Yes.
Boom.